You're listening to a Rock Candy podcast.
Welcome back to Hot Tea Hot Takes, where the tea is hot.
And the takes are hotter.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Evangeline.
And we come back to you after a little bit of a hiatus, I would say, because I don't think we've uploaded an episode in like 3 weeks, to talk to you about this is a little bit late, but people were talking about it a lot like a couple weeks ago, the new Bo Burnham release, Inside, right?
Right, we are. This is something that I wasn't really necessarily expecting. I don't know who was, like if you know, how much he had let people know. I did see some teaser kind of stuff right before it came out.
Yeah, I don't think he really teased it much until he was ready to release it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he basically disappeared off the map for like the last 5 years.
Yeah.
He literally, like, I mean, he mentions it in the special, but he had retired basically from live comedy shows because he kept having like violent panic attacks. And so this is, he didn't think he'd ever get back on stage. He did make that movie, the eighth grade movie.
Yes.
And that's like the last time anybody like saw or heard from him.
Right.
But apparently he was working on this all through quarantine.
Right, right. So if you don't know who Bo Burnham is, he's a very multi-talented man. He's a songwriter. He is a producer, comedian, and a creative mind. He's a writer. I read his book, or one of his books. And he has older comedy specials. Well, now that you ask, wait, what was it called? Sorry. I'll Google it. Hold on.
I watched his specials, but I didn't know he had a book.
Egghead.
Oh, nice.
It is, you know, it's similar concepts to some of his talk about creativity, about what it's like to be an artist. He often jokes about that. Mm-hmm. He often, and a lot of Inside is about that too.
Yeah.
But he has created a special for Netflix that is completely shot within one room in his house over quarantine.
Technically one building. It's his guest house. So there's a couple of different rooms, but it's still within one small area.
It is about... well, and it was completely like shot and performed and edited, and all the songs were written by him and performed by him. You know, there were some other people involved, but it's the majority of his own work. Mm. And it is a lot about, it's not like the old Bo Burnham specials where he's literally in front of a live audience, but it does include a lot of the same themes where it's like, some talking, some songs, like comedy songs, and, you know, a lot of very kind of meta kind of thoughts on creativity and, you know, fame and, you know, creating. Like, the first song is called Content, where he's like, you know, daddy's back with content, open wide, like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is also a very vulnerable thing. I think it felt more vulnerable than... honestly, anything else I've ever seen from him, because he kind of addresses this in one of the songs, there's a part where he basically does like a reaction video to his own song, and then it like layers and layers, it becomes more meta, like it goes in picture in picture, and he's reacting to the reaction to the reaction. And he kind of critiques himself, and he says, you know, I'm insufferable, that I want to be the intellectual all the time, but that's just to actually I critique myself as a self-defense, and then that's like another layer of it is that, you know, once I do that, then I'm more insufferable. And it's like he sees,
and he talks about how it's like, you know, when you I think if I'm more self-aware about being an asshole, I won't be, or a douchebag,
I am
anyway. It's like being self-aware doesn't actually absolve you of anything. And I think that one of the biggest themes of Bo Burnham's body of work in general, especially this, but I think just in general, if you watch the themes in some of his earlier comedy specials, Bo Burnham is somebody who suffers from being tragically self-aware, like painfully self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point that like so much of what he does is like he's so aware of everything, which is why I think he probably started having panic attacks and stuff like that. And also when you think about how much he's done in such a short period of time,
I know,
literally you can still find his old YouTube videos he made when he was 15 years old.
That's crazy.
They're on YouTube. I mean, he hasn't like they're still on his channel, and like he's literally just some teenage kid making songs in his bedroom. And from that he became the youngest person ever to be offered a full special by Comedy Central. Wow. I think he was in his mid-20s when that happened. And he's only 30 now. He literally just turned 30. He'll be, I think, 31 in August. But he's very young. I mean, he's like our age. And like he's done so much in a short period. He's released, I think, at least two, maybe three comedy... Well, at least three comedy specials with this one. Right. But I think he may have released another one before. So he's released at least three, maybe four comedy specials. And has written so much music. And if you even go back and listen to his, like, old music that he was writing when he was in high school, it's so good. Like, you can tell he's always been very lyrically talented. Like, he does this one called, like, Bo for Show or whatever, which is so funny. And I think he uploaded that in, like, 2007. And it's literally just him with a little Casio keyboard in his bedroom. And the whole thing is just him challenging himself to do as much clever wordplay as he can. Yeah. And, like, every single line is, like, 16 layers of wordplay. That's and it's amazing. Like, this is a kid. Like, I could not even fathom doing something this clever when I was this age.
Exactly. He's so talented. And he really is a great lyricist, like you said. You can see that definitely throughout this whole special.
We should just go through the songs.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So it starts off with content. Mm-hmm. It's kind of about, like I said before, he's very meta. So it's like he's aware of, you know, here I come. Mm-hmm. I'm coming back with something to feed you. Here you go. Like,
there's something about that line where he says, you basically voices something that we all had thought during the quarantine. It's like, if you had told me a year ago that I'd be locked inside of my home, I would have told you a year ago, interesting, now leave me alone. And then he goes, sorry that I look like a mess. I booked a haircut, but it got rescheduled. Robert's been a little depressed. Something about that line, Robert's been a little depressed, hits me like a dump truck every time. I'm like, I don't know why that line in particular just like rolls me over, but mm-hmm. I just feel like it's so relatable because who wasn't a little depressed the last year? Like, good God. It was like you were sitting in your home, you couldn't really go anywhere, everything was closed, and you turn on the news and it was just doomsday, 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 and it was like, terrible. It was awful. Like,
I mean, like, spoiler, but like, this is like a very, I found this to be a very, very, like, kind of gripping portrayal of depression as I've experienced it in the last year, and like how it, and anxiety in some places, mm-hmm. both of which are things that I've struggled with pretty badly. And, like, it just felt, I don't know, people can talk about depression a lot of different ways, but this was very much, like, hit the nail on the head for me, especially during the period where I was, you know, home a lot, because it was, like, I was job searching and doing other stuff, writing and stuff, but all at home. And the kind of, like, repetitive nature of that is enough to drive you insane.
Every day bled together. I mean, I remember so, because like, because I'm a school teacher, and school let out, obviously, schools shut down in like March. So even the rest of the school year, I was working, quote unquote, but it was all virtual, and so I'm a special teacher, I wasn't really doing that much. Right. And like, literally just being at home. So, like, my summer break, quote-unquote, was, like, from March to the next, like, fall till August. And so it was, like, almost 6 months of just being in my house most days. And sure, I'd go out and maybe go to the store or something like that. But, like, it was insane. Like, I'd wake up and I'm like, I have no idea what day it is. It's Tuesday? It's Sunday? I have no idea, because my church was shut down, everything. It was not like I could even gauge when the beginning of the week was. It was just, like, every day was the same.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. And it was, like, nothing I'd ever experienced. And I know it sounds so first world to say that as an American, because let's be honest, America never really locked down the way that a lot of other countries did.
Well, like, I kind of locked myself down because I was so terrified. And, like, it was before there were even, like, cases in North Carolina. So it was kind of, like, you know, a lot for what was actually going on. And then when, like, it really did get bad, I got a frontline worker job. Not really, essential worker. Mm-hmm. But, you know, working in a grocery store. So I was like, well, I don't know why I did this now. But anyway.
And we had to go through, like, the insane politicization of the virus. Yeah. And then, like, I'm wearing a mask. This is the new Holocaust or whatever the hell. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, what is happening?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that actually feeds into the next song very well, because comedy is about, like, it's, again, very meta, but he's just talking about how he's going to fix the world with comedy, and how it also definitely references the kind of woke, like,
white savior.
New white savior, like, oh, I'm being educated, I'm being enlightened, of last year, and how a lot of white people, you know, they sort of took the Black Lives Matter movement as a chance to just kind of self-actualize and become better versions of themselves for their own sake only. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to do that because you kind of go on your own journey, and it's very easy to keep that all inside and be like, now I'm enlightened mm-hmm. about race, you know? And it's like, he kind of plays on that and is like, you know, my comedy, you know, white men have had the floor for 400 yeah. years. Wait, what was
like,
that line?
He's like, American white guys. He was like, I'm a special kind of white guy. I self-reflected and I want to be an agent of change, so I'm going to use my privilege for the good. American white guys, we've had the floor for at least 400 years, so maybe I should just shut the fuck up. And then the sound cuts out for about 10 seconds and he's like, I'm bored. I don't want to do that. And it's like, that sums up that. Like the white saviorism to a T, because it's like, oh, hey, maybe we should just be quiet and get out of the way. And they're like, nah, yeah. I don't want to do that. That's boring. I want to be a front
line. I'd like to talk to you.
Like the horribly tone deaf things I would see on like TikTok last summer. Yeah. Like, let's be honest, the Black Lives Matter movement was sort of a blessing and a curse. Because on the one hand, yes, it was good that people were becoming more aware of certain things, but on the yeah. other hand, it was such a trend. And when yeah. the people got bored with it, it's like no one's talking about it anymore. Like yeah. this summer has been nothing compared to yeah. last summer, which is insane because last summer we were in the middle of a pandemic and yet we were marching in the streets like it was the 1960s.
Yeah.
And this summer we've done like nothing. No one's even talking. It's like, who cares? And it was like,
yeah,
it was like these problems haven't gone away like at all. And it's like when you're talking about going out or when the people would like make these TikToks, and obviously some of them were well-meaning, but some of them were just the worst. Like I remember this one white girl made this TikTok like a fantasy, you know, those POVs or whatever.
Oh, I know what
she's like,
say.
You're in the museum and they're talking about the Black Lives Matter movement and you flash back to how your black friend was beaten by the cops or something. It's like, what the
it's
hell?
Like POV, you're watching your black friend get beaten by a cop. I was like,
what?
Whoa.
What?
Yikes. Why are you fantasizing about that? That's crazy.
What is like, you're the hero of this. Like, what is going on?
It's just an excuse for people to cry on camera. Yeah. Like, fake cry. Be like, oh, my
Everyone
friend.
Thinks their cat is Everdeen or some shit. Like, please stop.
Yeah. It is insane. It's really insane. I mean, just how much things have changed. And, like, the people who are doing the real work never stopped, mm-hmm. you know, and they're still, you know, but it's just the performative nature of it was very, and I mean I'm guilty of it too. I think when the kind of zeitgeist passes, it is hard to keep that level of emotion and fervor up. And obviously I'm speaking from a place of privilege because I have the ability to not have that kind of emotion, but it is crazy. But I mean that he hits the nails on the head where it's like, you know, it is, you know, he in the video part of it, but like he does a pie chart. And he's like, on one side it's like Weird Al,
yeah,
on the other side it's like Malcolm X, and yeah. In the middle of the Venn diagram it's like me.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and it's like channel Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, which is obviously a joke to how white savory that movie was.
Exactly.
And this is a theme that comes up multiple times in the show where he's like, hey, maybe I should shut the fuck up. Maybe I'm not helping.
Yeah.
Maybe this is actually worse than doing nothing.
Oh my gosh, but, like, that skit where he's like. He's like, you know, there's a real question, like, does everybody have to share their opinions, like, all the time? Or is, like, are humans incapable of just, like, shutting the fuck up for, like, 10 minutes? And he's like, maybe I should shut the fuck up. No.
He's like, you know, and I know what you're thinking. Well, you're not shutting the fuck up right now. And that's true. And then it just cuts off.
Exactly.
And it's just like, you know, he's very, again, self-aware in terms of like, yeah, I realize that I'm just like speaking from my place of privilege as a white guy, and I'm just sharing my opinion, and maybe no one gives a shit, and maybe I should just be quiet because maybe I'm not the one to speak out about these things.
Right. Yeah. No, I definitely feel that kind of like, I have felt that way before where you're like making art and then you'd like step back and you're like, oh no, should I be quiet? You know, like, maybe this is bad too, you know, that kind of thing. It's a constant like, is my art helping or hurting, that sort of thing. The next one is called FaceTime with My Mom, which is about FaceTiming with your mom, really any time, but specifically during the pandemic because you didn't get to see your mom mm-hmm. for a long time. And then, you know, it's just funny. It's just like, you know, she's looking for her glasses and her thumb's over the camera and, you know, her hair's wet because she just got out of the shower. And you say, did you just get out of the shower? And she's like, oh, how'd you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, you know.
I know, he captures mundanity very well.
Yeah.
Like, just the mundane aspects of a conversation yeah. where it's just like, oh, you know, you ask these sort of banal questions or whatever, and then, like, his dad walks by the camera, and he's just like, hey, bud, and he's like, oh, hey, Dad, and it's the deepest talk we ever had. I was watching it with my boyfriend, and that part really oofed him, and not me as much, but, like, he was just like, oh, God.
Oh, I know.
Because I feel like with
if
men...
If you have a dad who cannot share his feelings
exactly,
well.
And with men especially, I feel like men sharing their feelings with their sons is an especially rare thing, so it's like, from my boyfriend's perspective, it's like, I mean, he and his dad have a, you know... a cordial relationship, but it's certainly not like they have deep talks.
So I know, they're kind of acquaintances.
Exactly. I'm just like, I feel like most men are like that with their fathers, and it's just like, oh boy.
No, my dad, he's very expressive.
Yes, your dad is very expressive, but he's kind of a special case. Also, he doesn't have sons. So.
That's true. That's true. He got to be very expressive. Yeah. But it's toxic masculinity for you, causing men to not want to like talk to their sons and be expressive. It's very sad.
It is.
Talk about their feelings. Everybody talk about your feelings. Yeah. Anyway, the next one is How the World Works.
Oh my God.
He plays the piano and he has a sock puppet friend. In the first part, he's like super cheery and happy and he says like...
It's like very Sesame Street.
Yeah, like the birds fly and the bees buzz and, you know, everything works together. And then Mr. Socko comes on and he's like, systematic
compression. I've got his whole verse because I have the whole verse memorized because it's so great. It's like, the basic narrative heard in every history class is demonstrably false and pedagogically classes. Don't you know the world is built by blood and genocide and exploitation? The global network of capital essentially functions to separate the worker from the means of production, and the FBI killed Martin Luther King. Private property is inherently theft, and neoliberal fascists are destroying the left, and every politician, every cop in the street protects the interests of the pedophilic corporate elite.
Yeah, and he's like, Mr. Socko, you can't come on here and say that kind of stuff.
Just like, he's like, oh, and then the extreme's like, that sounds complicated. He's like, no shit. And he's like, well, what can I do to help? He's like, I don't know, read a book or something, but just don't burden me with the weight of educating you. And he's like, I was sorry, I was trying to be a better person. Why do rich fucking white people insist on seeing every sociopolitical conflict through the myopic lens of your own self-actualization?
Exactly.
This is not about you. Like, exactly. That sums up all of the, like, performative activism we saw last summer in terms of just, like, white people, even when it comes to doing the right thing, can't help but center themselves.
Yeah.
So it's like they get out there and they're like, oh yeah, I want to help Black Lives because it makes me feel like a good person.
I'm learning. I'm growing. Let me tell you about how I'm learning and growing. And what's hard is, like, it's rough, like, because you want to learn and grow. Like, the point is to become better. But if you make it about you, then you're defeating the purpose. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, especially, like, when he says, like, you know, read a book. It is not my, you know, it's not my duty to educate you. It's exhausting, which is, like, so much of, like, again, last summer where it was, like, you're just, like, going to your Black friends and being like, hey, teach me about racism. Yeah, and they're like, no!
Yeah. And it's good because the obliviousness that white people have had the privilege of having for so long, it's like even the most well-meaning white people, they just approach you out of fucking nowhere like, oh my God, I just realized racism exists? Can you explain all of that to me, please?
Please. Tell me about trauma.
I remember when I was literally in high school, I was still a teenager, I was in high school, and there was a whole grown white woman who would tend to, like, message me when she had racial questions or, like, wanted to explain something to her boys and wasn't quite sure how to. And, like, I don't hate her. Like, she was a sweet lady. But, like, it's just absurd that I was burdened with that at such a young age. It's just, like, but you know it's because I was probably one of the only Black people she knew because I had babysat her kids or whatever. And I was like, are you kidding me right now?
Yeah. I mean, number one, you were still a kid, basically. Like, that's not, like, your job. To teach somebody, I mean, you know, the internet exists, books exist.
I know, and it's like, I mean, like, and again, I really feel like a lot of these people don't mean any harm by it, but it's just like, it reeks of the privilege you had to just have been oblivious to this for so long, when Black people have lived with this reality for their whole lives, and so it's just like, I was born Black, I've always been Black, none of this is new to me, and so it's like, you and me experienced this, and you want to come up and be like, oh, hey, I just now realized that this was a thing. Can you explain it all to me?
And, like, I'm saying this, but, like, I had the same problem. I mean, I'm white, and it's exactly the same thing. You live your life not realizing that there are realities for which, you know, in which Black people live that you had no idea about. And it is, you know, it is part of being a good ally in this fight to not make it about you. And it is, you know... and to not burden your Black friends mm-hmm. or any, you know, BIPOC friends with explaining to you why they're oppressed, you know, do your own research, mm-hmm. basically.
And also the realization, like, I feel like for a lot of white people, it's not of malice, but it's just, like, they have literally been centered for so long. Yeah. It's like you literally have never experienced not being the center of the conversation, so it's very hard for them to break that habit of, like, oh, wait, here's what I think. Like, yeah. And you can see that whenever they get in their feelings about, like, these allies will get so upset if, like, a BIPOC person calls them out for, like, anything.
Yeah.
Like, the whole, like, hey, colonizer thing that's going on TikTok now. I'm like, oh, I didn't know what to be called a colonizer. It hurts my feelings. I'm like, your feelings are not what's centrally important here, Rebecca. Come on.
Exactly.
Why have people been through so much, like, literal genocide, and you're over here like, oh, you called me a colonizer. That hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
Like, really?
I know. It sucks. Well, anyway.
It's segueing to White Woman's Instagram.
Yeah. White Woman's Instagram is a song about a white woman's Instagram. I have a hot take, and this is going to sound really... really bad because I am a white woman, but this was my least favorite song on this thing, and here's why. It's not because I am a white woman and I am, like, offended by this. Like, basically all he talks about, like, you know, latte art and tiny pumpkins and, like, all the stuff that's on a white woman's Instagram. I just felt like it didn't fit with the vibe of the rest of... I felt like this would have fit really well on one of his old specials mm-hmm. and not this. It felt, like, so out of place. And the reason why I think he put it in there is because the rest of it is so depressing. I mean, it is very funny.
Even the song has a depressing bit.
It is. It does have a depressing bit. And you know, it is... lighter, and it pokes fun. I mean, there's a little bit of a shade of, like, let women have, like, nice things and enjoy things mm-hmm. that I'm a little bit like, because he's a little bit, like, poking fun at it and to a point where I'm kind of like, let them have their, you know, if they're not hurting anybody, let them have their fun.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it just felt a little at odds with the rest of it. Like, it's a very trendy song right now, like, it's on TikTok and stuff, and so it you know, it works in that way, but in terms of the rest of the piece, I just don't get it, you know?
I have sort of mixed feelings on it. I would agree that it feels a little out of place. It doesn't fit the vibe of a lot of the rest of the special. Parts of it do, but it definitely, I also felt the same way about FaceTiming with my mom.
Yeah.
But I didn't hate it, but it didn't feel like it quite fit the narrative of the rest of it. And I also did, like, kind of play with it, like, is this a much misogynistic because it's like, I mean, I don't get the vibe of him being, like, malicious.
No.
Like, I don't think he's like, women are bad because they like pumpkins or whatever. It's just like, you know, it's just kind of like, it's so played out, like, oh, haha, basic white girl.
It's like we passed this joke a long time ago.
Yeah, and the only thing that I will say for the song is that I do think that, like all of the songs, there is a bit of a deeper meaning to it.
Yeah.
And that when he gets to that bridge part where he is taking on the persona of the white woman in question, and he talks about, her dedicating a picture to her mother who's passed away. And you notice that the camera work of it, like, the whole time he's talking about the listing stuff, it's a very narrow frame as though you're looking at a phone screen. And then during that part, the screen widens.
Right.
And I think his goal there was to display, like, when we are scrolling through Instagram, you know, we're just seeing clips of people's lives, just silly little things that they like, harmless little whatevers. And then, but occasionally people get really real. And so, like, occasionally it's like, that verse is, like, so... completely out of left field, because you're just like, oh, she likes latte foam art and pumpkins. Mom, I miss you so much. I've been doing stuff with my life. I wish you were here. It's like, whoa. Like,
I almost thought that the song was going to end with that, and I think I would have liked it better if it had.
Yeah.
Because I think that if he had kind of pulled back and been like, actually, these are real complex people. These are not just, like, basic bitches with their Starbucks. Like, these people have complex internal lives. Like, I wish it had ended that way, but he goes back to the... You know, I don't know, having a umbrella on a rainy day and a salad. Like, I mean, it just, It reminds me of when people make fun of teenage girls because they like boy bands and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just like, let women like things.
I know,
like,
it's just
God.
Like, it definitely feels out of place. And, like, well, I wouldn't go so far. It does not feel as mean-spirited as some of those jokes.
No, no.
But, like, it does feel like maybe this would be more at least, like, 2015 or something.
Exactly.
Like, are we not past this kind of joke?
It just feels like, it feels like one of his older songs about, like, you know, Katy Perry. Making fun of Katy Perry's music.
Exactly. Like,
it
that just seems like
old.
A different, like, a completely completely different mindset, cultural mindset that we were in. Yeah. It doesn't feel, I would agree, like, it's not the worst thing ever, but no. I don't think it fits the special very well. And I think it's a little bit out of place, like, just kind of, like, dated, like, all right,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
White women love their pumpkin spice lattes, like, who cares? It's so, like.
I know. I just want to let women live their lives. Anyway, next is Unpaid Intern, which is a very short little song about.
One more thing I will say, but someone else made this point on TikTok, and I completely agree. I would rather white women embrace their culture of pumpkin spice lattes and little tiny latte foam art and stuff like that than appropriate other cultures. It's like, what would you rather them do? Love their little Han Solo look or start wearing box braids? Like, I feel like of all the things, let white women do their little harmless, stupid
things.
Did you
say Han Solo look?
Yeah, you know, you ever heard that? When the women wear, like, the riding boots, the leggings, and then, like, the little jackets.
I thought you meant the hairstyle, and I was like...
No. They call it the Han Solo when, like, they walk around with the riding boots and the leggings and then the vest over the white shirts or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Christian Girl Autumn with the big hat.
Exactly. Big hats, big scarf, infinity scarf. Yeah, the Christian Girl Autumn look. I'm like, look, if that's... I would rather you do that than try to walk around looking like a black girl.
Yeah, like, do your hair like Jennifer Aniston. Yeah. Like, that is, like, peak white woman culture. And that's, you know, I don't know. I said that, and now I'm worried that, like, that is something that we stole as well. Yeah. But, you know, anyway.
It was like, you know, when you see that, like, I saw one TikTok recently where this, like, white hairstyle was basically showing tracks, like, glue-in tracks.
Oh, I saw that.
The future of hair extension. I'm like, bitch, black women have been doing that for 30 years. Yeah. Like, what is going on here?
Exactly. It's like, I feel like if I even, like, bring up something right now, you're going to be like, well, black people did that first. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez. Anyway, the next song is Unpaid Intern, which, like you said, is a very short song.
Yeah, it's just about, he said that, this is the one that he makes the reaction video to. It's very, like, you know, he's basically reacting to his own song, but he says that he wanted it to be, like, those old songs that are about the working class from, like, the 40s and 50s, but this one is about unpaid interns who are kind of, like, you know, he says they're, like, you know, barely human, like,
somehow legal.
Going to get coffee and, you know, sitting in the meetings and not saying anything, and, you know, it's...
Yeah, it's an observational sort of song about, like, modern-day labor exploitation. Mm-hmm. Because there's also a lot of capitalist critique in this special.
Yes. Speaking of which, the next song is my favorite song.
Oh, yes. And so he's criticizing a lot of that stuff. And then, like I said, he's also doing the meta-criticism of himself. And he's like, yeah, this is, like, what I was trying to do with this song. And then he's like, well, this is why I'm actually an asshole. And it's just, like, there's so many layers
to it. It's good, though. It's really good. I really like that part because it was just very, like, very vulnerable.
Bezos
the next one is
one.
Bezos One, which is this driving, pounding song about Jeff Bezos.
It's so good. Like, it's so bad, but it's so good.
It's like, you know, Jeffrey Bezos. I can't even remember.
I got it pulled up. CEO entrepreneur born in 1964, Jeffrey Bezos. Come on, Jeffrey, you can do it. Pave the way, put your back into it. Tell us why, show us how. Look at where you came from, look at you now. Zuckerberg and Gates and Buffett, amateurs can fucking suck it. Fuck their wives, drink their blood. Come on, Jeff, get them! And then he was a synth solo.
Get them! I know, the scream at the end is insane. I just love this song because it's that kind of, like, hustle grind mentality that all those YouTubes, it's like, all those YouTubers, like, make videos about where it's like, get them! Like, I'm cheering on you and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg because you're billionaires and I'm not and you're who I want to be and I want you to take over the world!
There's two interesting observations I'll make about this. First of all, this comes from, like, he's alluding to the fact that Jeff Bezos has always perpetuated and exaggerated a rags-to-riches story talking about emphasizing how he started Amazon in a garage, and there's even a picture of, like, his old computer, like a hand-printed Amazon sign or whatever. However, despite this, in July 2018, a Business Insider article revealed that Bezos' parents invested roughly $250,000 into his company in the 1990s.
He was rich his whole time!
And his maternal grandfather was also the owner of a 25,000-acre ranch in Cotulla, Texas. So, like, this is the house. Like, this is fucking the house he was living in. He was not, like, some poor...
You know who this sounds like? I'm not going to say his name.
Oh, yeah, but you know.
He got a small loan of $1 million.
A small loan of $1 million. It's just like People are like, oh, he brought himself up by his bootstrap. I'm like, fucking, whose grandparents can give them $250,000? Like, what?
Right.
Like, get it.
But yeah, it is like, I don't know. I just love the kind of idea of that song. And there's Bezos too that comes later.
Yeah. But the worst part about it, though, is that irony is dead, because I have, no lie, seen people on TikTok completely miss the point of that song.
Oh.
And they will post it and they will be like, yeah, respect the hustle. Jeff Bezos is great. I'm going to be like him too one day. Or they're showing off their Amazon hauls or whatever. Ooh.
Yeah, it feels very like, it feels very easy for people to miss the point, because people do idolize those men.
Yeah.
Like, they feel like they are the ideal. And it is, yeah, absolutely the opposite of what he's trying to say here. But, you know, irony is dead.
I know, it really is. I mean, you can't, it's like, it's too subtle. It's like, you know, I got it because I already hate Bezos. And there's plenty of other capitalist criticism in the show. But divorced from it, yeah, these people are just up here like, yeah, Jeff Bezos is so awesome. It's like, oh,
that's
God.
Who I want to be. No.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, so the next one is called Sexting. I think it's very funny.
Yes.
It is about sexting in the modern age. I love when he's like, she sends a peach, I send a carrot, she sends a Ferris wheel. It's a little vague. I don't know what it means.
He's like, oh, it's no, what if she abstract. Thinks I'm implying that my vagina is as big as a Ferris wheel?
I was like, that's the thing. You hit the wrong emoji, and it's like, I don't know what this means.
And also, I thought it was very interesting, the emojis that he talks about. He says, you send me a peach, I send a carrot back, you send a Ferris wheel. That's pretty accurate. I send back a ticket stub implying the Ferris wheel's your body, and I'd really love admission to it. I'm thinking, okay, like, the peach I've seen, but carrot?
The carrot?
I thought we all agreed that the eggplant was the penis, so I don't know what the carrot is.
Why is it carrot? That's so funny.
I've certainly never seen a Ferris wheel used in a sexual context. So I know. I'm a little confused.
I know. That's so funny. Yeah, and then they just talk about, like, you know, he's like, you know, send me a picture of your boobs, and she does it, and then she's like, okay, it's your turn. And he's like, why did I do this?
No,
like,
no, I don't want to send it
back. I'll never learn, because he doesn't want to send it back. But it's funny. I mean, it's really just about how awkward it is, kind of, especially when you're in, you know, quarantine and, like,
yeah.
I
know that's the only way that really, we can have intimacy. A lot of
I know.
A lot of people.
Yeah, you know. And it just, you know, this was not really a problem for me during quarantine. I didn't really have anybody to, you know, text. But nonetheless, yeah.
I think you and I both found our boyfriends at roughly the same time, and it was like toward the latter half of quarantine, yeah. So it wasn't quite the same.
Exactly. There was a little bit more going out and about, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, the song is very funny.
Yeah, so that's more classic Bo Burnham too. Like, I can see him just doing that, like, in any kind of special. That's one that felt like it fit, but it was also a more funny one.
And
more
I
other.
Love how he goes just AT&T randomly throughout that song.
AT&T, or when he just, like, says random things, like, he's like, another night on my own, pussy, sitting alone, titties.
I know, and it's very sad because his phone dies and he's sitting there, like, with his dick in one hand and his phone in the other, just like, I'm very lonely.
Oh my god.
We
can all relate, though.
Right.
And then jumping into Look Who's Inside Again, which is a deceptively cheery sounding song, which is actually sort of sad.
Yeah.
And then, like, he reprises it later and it gets very sad. But we'll get to that. But yeah, he does Look Who's Inside Again, which is a talk about how he used to be in his room, you know, well, he's like trying to be funny and stuck in a room. There isn't much more to say about it. Being in, trying to get something out of it. And this is a reference to sort of his, like said, the beginnings of his career, where he was in his house, in his room, making music, making content by himself.
Right.
And it's like, you know, like he said, I was a kid, it was stuck in my room. There isn't much more to say about it. When you're a kid and you're stuck in your room, you'll do any old shit to get out of it. Try making faces, try telling jokes, making little sounds. And he's basically reflecting, oh, man, I'm back here again. I'm doing this again.
Yeah.
And this chorus is, well, look who's inside again. Went out to look for a reason to hide again. Well, buddy, you found it. Now come up with your hands up. We got you surrounded. And it's like, basically, like, you know, he's like, I'm in the room and I'm sort of sad about it, but also I'm afraid to be outside.
Yeah, like the comfort of not being known, of being inside. I mean, like, being in quarantine kind of triggered that, like, it's not agoraphobia because that's a real thing, but it's kind of like where you remember why you have social anxiety and you forget how to be as open with people as you used to be and you forget how to interact the same way and everything outside becomes a lot scarier than it used to be. I definitely felt that way where you're like, I don't remember how do I talk to people? Yeah, I don't know. It becomes very intimidating. So like, almost like being inside is like this horrible curse because you're like, I can't see anybody and it's a scary thing outside, but also it's like safer in here. And yeah, it's a very, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that line, went out to look for a reason to hide again, is so poignant because it's like, I went out because it felt like the right thing to do, but the whole time I'm just looking for an excuse to go back and hide.
Yeah, right, exactly. Especially knowing the fact that he had such trouble with anxiety and panic when he was in front of people. And he did find a reason to hide because he was having such a hard time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's sad, really. But yeah, it's one of the more kind of emotional songs.
And it also speaks to like how the whole special is basically sort of like a glimpse into the creative process. Mm-hmm. Like there's kind of a separation between Robert the person and Bo the entertainer.
Yeah, for sure.
And so like it's like when even at the end of this song when he finished it, he's like recording it and he's like, all right, let's do another take. Yeah. Like it's like the whole
Shows a lot of that stuff. A lot of that kind of behind the scenes of how he's like making and revising and rewriting and having a hard time getting through takes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very cool. It feels like I don't know, it's like behind the lens in a way because he's creating and he's also creating based on that creation.
Yeah, and it's like, it's how much of this is the performance and how much of this
is real.
Is real. Because it's like, and there's another point where he's like just weeping next to the camera and then it kind of fades out. And it's like, was that like, a genuine emotion or did he script that? Like, what's happening? I don't even know. Exactly. The lines are so blurred.
Exactly. It feels, I don't know, a lot, it felt very authentic in its despair to me. Yeah. You know? The next one is called Problematic, which is a great song. He kind of does it as an 80s workout jam, but it is about, you know, I've said things in the past that I am not proud of, and I'm learning, and I'm changing, and growing, and, but I'm problematic. Sort of like, you know, he's poking fun at the, you know, I'm problematic, I'm a bad boy.
Apology. Like, like this sort of like, oh yeah, that's a very good way to put it. It's almost fetishistic. Like this sort of like self-flagellating, like, oh, look at me taking accountability. Oh, I'm so bad. Oh, it's just like, oh, I don't know.
I didn't know any better.
Like, and he's also like pointing, like making fun of like the idea. Like he is, I feel like in a way, genuinely feeling remorseful for some of the, because I mean, like if you look at some of those older jokes, some of them were problematic, you know, like he made jokes that use, you know, ableist slurs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He once tricked a whole audience of mostly white people into saying the N-word, which the devilish part of me thinks is kind of funny, but he shouldn't have done it. And it's like, you know, like I get, the what's socially acceptable in comedy changes, like we get, I don't know. I have mixed feelings whenever someone talks about, like, cancel culture, whenever someone's like, you know, this was never okay. It's like, some stuff may have, on an objective level, never been okay, but it's impossible to deny that things were more socially acceptable in certain time periods.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you recorded the shit I said when I was in middle school, I'd be canceled in a heartbeat, even in high school. Like, I mean, it's just like, I mean, not that I was going around, like, saying slurs or, like, being, like, horrible, but just, like, the general, you know, the gay jokes and, like, the stuff that we would just do so flippantly without really thinking about it. It's just like, you know, you just, a lot of, like, people definitely did some dumb stuff in those times, and also just, like, what people think is acceptable does change.
The perception is totally different now.
Even like in 2010, like the thing, like I don't think that like Katy Perry could release "I Kissed a Girl" in 2021.
No. It would be seen as queerbaiting.
It would be queerbaiting. She'd be roasted alive. Like I don't think that. I feel like there's so much that you could not get away with the way you could even 10, 15 years ago.
I know. Like there was this post going around where there was a picture of like Olivia Rodrigo and a friend, and they were like, you know, kind of close, and you know, they were, you know, sort of on top of each other, not like in a, you know, but just sort of like, you know, girlfriends, like girlfriends. And this person was like, she's a queerbaiter. Look at this. She's like, why are you not giving her the same energy you're giving Billie Eilish for being a queerbaiter? I'm like, bro, like girls what? Can be friends too. And, like, it really wasn't queerbaiting. It just was like girls being friends, uh-huh. not like gals being pals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like I don't know. At a certain point, like it can go a little overboard. And I am very much a person who wants to hold people accountable, but if we start making a parody of ourselves with the way we're calling people out, it's just going to completely backfire.
It's already been doing that. Like, think about, like, all the BuzzFeed stuff or, like, the things that people make fun of now that, you know, like, oh, the liberals are over here doing this. And they make everybody look embarrassed by doing stuff like that. Yeah. Like, calling every time a celebrity looks at someone of the same sex queer baiting. Like, okay, what is this? Like, you know, or, like, people just take concepts that on their face are, like, reasonable, and then they take it to this extreme degree. Like, oh, it's bad when, like, predatory older men prey on younger women. Yeah, that's, I would agree with that. But then you get over here and, like, calling, like, George Naval Clooney a pedophilic or grooming relationship, despite the fact that Amal Clooney was a successful human rights lawyer that was 36 years old when she married George. Yeah. Who cares if he's like 15 years older? Like, she was clearly an adult. She wasn't a child. Like, give me a break. Like, it's just, so it gets out of hand.
Well, it's performative. It's people wanting to be right so bad that they're starting to pick apart things that are really, if you take a step back, like, really a stretch. Yeah. So I don't know. I think it is people wanting to be to pick holes in everything and find the wrong in everything, and like I think to a certain extent that's like it is good to be aware of the things that we used to say were okay and are not now, especially if you're finding those things in yourself. Like, I'm very much realizing how fat phobic I've been my whole life.
Oh, absolutely.
And as a bigger person, like I am having to call myself out in a way and say, like, hey, like, why are you feeling that way about yourself or another person or whatever? I think that is absolutely changing behavior is very much something that we want to be doing. But if you're pushing it to the extreme where it comes, like, visibly and, like, obviously, ridiculous, mm-hmm. like, you're making a mockery of something that's very serious and very important. So, why are we talking about this?
Oh, I know. We were talking about the problematic song. And another thing about that song is, like, you can tell that Bo is very much sort of self-lampooning and lampooning the idea of performative apologies, because even in the second verse, he's literally like, oh, before I go on, I need to apologize for what I said in the first 30 seconds of this song. He's, like, apologizing in the middle of the song for the first verse of the song.
And he says, like, when I was little, I dressed up as Aladdin
for
Halloween, and I didn't darken my skin, but I still feel weird about it. And, like, I was like,
what
should
I do? Should I throw away the costume or whatever?
And should then, I burn it? I don't know.
When you talk about, like, people missing the point, again, I saw people missing the point of this song on TikTok because they were using it to show off their, like, racist Halloween costumes from when they were little kids. I'm like, why would you share that? Why does no one needs to see that? Who does this benefit? Like, I'm really showing this, like, offensive Native American stereotype they dressed up with when they were five. And it's like, no one cares. That's the whole reason you brought up the Aladdin thing, because no one cares if you dressed up like Aladdin when you were 17 and you didn't darken your skin. That's not really a big deal. Yeah. It's like you're apologizing for something that nobody was going to call you out for because it's dumb, but, like, you're avoiding talking about the stuff that you're really, that people are really criticizing by bringing up something trivial and goofy. Like, you know, like white people get on TikTok and be like, black people, is it cultural appropriation if I eat this piece of fried chicken? Like, shut the fuck up. Like, you know that that's
and
not...
And then, like,
you
yesterday they said the N-word.
Exactly.
It's like, okay.
It's like, you know that is not the issue.
Yeah.
Like, and it feels like gaslighting and stuff like that, and just, like, the joke. It's like, no one cares if you, like, did something insensitive when you were 12 and didn't know any better, but, like, just do work on now. Like, how does that help people that, I'm confessing my sins and just, like, randomly trauma dumping and people have come, like, people will literally show, and I speak as a black creator on Letter, people will come into my comment section to say shit like, man, when I grew up, I used to say racial slurs and hate crime black people. I'm so glad I've grown and changed. Like, why would you tell me this?
Like, you're a priest and they're confessing to you?
Literally, they will literally
like, I don't want to know.
Solution from random black people. I'm like, bruh, take that up with your therapist or something. I don't know what's going on.
I don't know you.
No, like, exactly. No, I assure you that no, anyone listening out there, I promise you that no random stranger who is of a non-white race wants to hear about how you used to be racist.
It's like, I used to be in the KKK. Will you forgive me?
Exactly. Like, or how racist your family is. Like, I don't care.
I don't care.
Like, jeez.
That sucks.
Yeah, it's like, but again, it's like one of those songs where people are doing the exact thing he's making fun of. I mean, like, oh, look at this costume. I'm dressed up like Pocahontas. Like, bruh.
Right. And, like, like, you know, at a certain point, like, there is a limit where it's like, okay, blackface, we all would have known, should have known that this was never okay. Like, that's why Shane Dawson got canceled.
Oh, yeah,
like,
that's what I was going to mention, Shane Dawson, because when speaking about, like, apologizing for things that people weren't necessarily calling you out on or avoiding talking about other things, Shane Dawson was being called out not just for the blackface and the racially insensitive skits, but also for, like, pedophilia and, like, grooming children. He made, like, sexually explicit comments to underage girls. And when he did his apology video, he was like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry for, like, doing blackface that one time. And it's like, not that that was okay, but a lot of other YouTubers were doing similar stuff at the time. But you didn't even mention the pedophilia. Like, I think more people were upset about that.
Absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, his skits were offensively, horrendously racist. And he made a lot of money on those skits, too. But he never has, I mean, I don't know, maybe he did.
I don't think he's ever really addressed it.
Did he ever say he's not a pedophile? Did he say it? I don't know, maybe he did.
Oh,
did he mean it? I don't know.
About fucking a cat on his podcast.
God, he sucks. He sucks
he's
so
such
bad.
He's a bad person. I don't understand how he was
and
loved.
And he's trying
somebody
to come back, too. I'm like, I've watched some really good videos recently about whether cancel culture works, because
it doesn't at least
because,
not for white men.
You know, they were talking about, it was Smokey Glow on YouTube, and she was talking about James Charles, Shane Dawson, David Dobrik, and Toddy Westbrook, and like whether you can, you know, text, you know, sexually explicit things to minors, minor fans like James Charles did, whether you can be a pedophile and a racist, whether you can dangle your best friend from a crane until he has brain damage, and then come back, that's David Dobrik, and then come back to the internet just like, new vlog, like, I mean,
I know, or like, what about like fucking the Paul brothers?
Yeah.
How many times they got canceled and came right back, like,
filming dead
bodies? It's like freaking Logan Paul's literally out there, like, filming a dead body.
Yeah.
He gets on the camera, and you know, like, what kills me about that video is that it wasn't like a live vlog. I mean, that would have been bad enough, but like, maybe you could argue, okay, it was in the moment, he didn't know what to do. But he literally filmed it, went back, edited it, edited out the swear words, like, clipped it.
He knew.
And it was a whole video, then uploaded it, and it stayed up on YouTube for hours, and YouTube did not delete it. Like, he's the one who finally took it down.
YouTube is culpable.
Absolutely, because they pay him millions of dollars to do stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just like, they ended up like, briefly, I don't think they canceled it. They suspended one of his shows. But they're also very inconsistent with how they enforce the rules.
Yeah.
Because they canceled PewDiePie's show completely because he said the N-word. And, like, I'm not, you know, going to sit here and fight
for
death for PewDiePie. But, like, it's a little absurd that you're going to ban him for saying a slur. But then Logan Paul showed a dead corpse to children.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, here's a slap on the wrist, but you can go back and make it. Like, what's happening?
Yeah, it feels very inconsistent. I think YouTube knows who their cash cows are, and they don't want to get rid of somebody who is going to, you know, bring views and bring engagement to the platform.
But PewDiePie does that, too. He's the most subscribed user on the platform, so
it's,
I still don't quite understand.
It's like, very odd.
Like, I mean, PewDiePie still made millions of dollars off YouTube, and continues to, because I think he's still the most subscribed individual on the platform. There's some larger companies, but, like, I think he's the only individual person with, like,
true.
A million subscribers. And so, or 100 million or whatever. But, yeah, so it's, like,
it's just, basically, her point in that video was, like, cancel culture is so temporary that it doesn't actually have a lasting effect. So people know now that they can get, quote-unquote, canceled and come back without negative repercussions. Now, of course, David Dobrik lost a huge amount of money because of this. And, like, money, I think, to a lot of people is the end-all, be-all, end-all, so losing sponsorships was very important that people did pull out and show him, like, this is wrong. But, like, James Charles is, like, barely lost his sponsorship with, or his collab with Morphe. Like, they, like, they're, like, we're cutting ties, but his stuff was still up on the site for a long time. So, like, he's not seeing the consequences of his actions. And because of that, like, cancel culture is not working. It's actually just becoming a mockery of itself.
Exactly. Like, one of the things is, like, you know, it might be coming from a good place, but not only do people try to cancel people for silly things, but also it is so
temporary,
disproportionately weaponized against, like, women and minorities than it is against white men. I mean, we want a perfect example. You remember
talked about Janet Jackson a lot of times, and I want to talk about her again.
Janet Jackson is a great example, but that's actually not what I was thinking of.
Okay.
I was thinking of a more recent example on TikTok. Do you remember that kerfuffle that happened a few months ago with Dixie and Charli D'Amelio and the dinosaur nuggets?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, well, they made a whole thing about, like, how they didn't like the squirrels, and, like, they tried to, like, fucking burn them alive for, like, it only lasted for, like, 2 days. But they were, like, really mad at Dixie and Charlie because they didn't like snails, because who does?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, but meanwhile, fucking, I think it was Noah Beck or one of those other dudes that also hangs out with him, literally, like, a couple weeks before that had assaulted a waiter for telling him not to vape in the restaurant.
It was Bryce Hall.
Yeah, Bryce Hall.
Idiot.
I know. He literally, like, fist fought a waiter for telling him not to vape in a restaurant. And no one said a damn word about that. And, like, Tony Lopez fucking groomed children. And then, like, everyone just, like, I'm like, I'm sorry. But, like, not that, not that I care that much about the D'Amelio sisters, but you're gonna roast them for not liking snails.
Well, and also, Charlie's a minor. Charlie's still a minor.
Yeah.
The Lopez brothers, I don't know if they're both overage, but, I mean, Tony is.
Yeah, Tony for is, for sure.
Bryce Hall
is definitely over 18.
These are adults. And, yeah. And Bryce Hall has had the cops called to his mansion multiple times because of parties during the pandemic. They find him, but not very much.
Yeah.
So again, like, these little kind of, like, ooh, slap on the wrist. Uh-huh. And then we're like, Charlie D'Amelio is spoiled. She's a brat, blah, blah, blah. And, like, to the point where, you know, she cries on her lives. Like,
yeah,
and she's 16. Like, she's so young.
She's a kid, and it's like,
or 17.
Okay, yeah, I think she's 17 now. But it's like, oh, the D'Amelios are, like, bratty little girls. They're literally spoiled rich girls. I mean, they literally are rich girls.
And
like,
Dixie,
the fact that teenage girls are acting a little bratty is not the end of the world. They're like every other teenage girl on the planet. Like,
and she's become one of the most, you know, popular. I mean, can you imagine what that does to your psyche? Yeah. I just feel like there are men committing crimes, and we're making fun of a teenage girl and shaming her for not liking a snail.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever. Like, sure, she acted a little bratty, but, like, can we focus on the real problem at hand?
And we also want them to, we also try to push these, like, random celebrities into, like, speaking about things they have no business speaking on. Like, well, why doesn't Charlie speak about the Israeli-Palestine conflict? Do you want her to? I really don't think you want her to do that.
Like, yeah. Like, now, granted, like, you know, the D'Amelio family did travel too much. During
they can be criticized for that, for sure.
But at the same time, you know, like, it's her family, you know? Yeah. Like, at a certain point, like, we gotta back up and think about how, you know, we've forgiven people for things that are way, way worse than you know, these, you know, smaller things that people are being assaulted for on the internet. And it is really hard to see people who have committed literal crimes,
yeah.
Sorry, not little crimes, just kind of have that swept under the rug. Like, what's hard in the age of the internet is that everything is about receipts, even crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, so much of this whole James Charles scandal, or the, you know, reckless endangerment of David Dobrik and the Vlog Squad, is just kind of like, well, where's the texts? Where's the emails?
Receipts?
Like, you know, do you have, like, proof? Like, that sort of stuff. And it's like, yeah, you committed a crime. Like, you know, with James Charles is a little bit different. Like, of course, you know, Jeff Winnick is not going to, you know, press charges because he's like, you know, David Dobrik, he's my friend, he's my buddy. Like, he almost killed me. Yeah. But,
but we're buds. Anyway, moving on, because we still have, like, half the thing to go.
I have a lot of thoughts about that.
Me too.
It's sad to see manipulative bad people being given so much money and so much fame and power.
And things like YouTube and TikTok have only made that so much worse, because
people
can very easily monetize being a terrible person, and it's like there are very little repercussions for it.
Especially if they have a child audience.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's why I also don't get me started on YouTube families and people who monetize their literal babies. I'm sorry, but your 4-year-old should not be constantly viewed by millions of strangers.
No,
that's a whole different issue
for
another show. Anyway,
it's bad enough.
So the next one is turning 30.
He turns 30, like, live in
this
special.
Yeah, live in the show.
And he talks about turning 30 and how he feels like, you know.
He made that on my birthday. 2020.
He did?
Yeah, because his birthday is August 21st, mm-hmm. and so he made it, like, before midnight on August 21st.
Oh.
But my birthday is August 20th.
Oh, my gosh, that's nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of panic that I think everybody in their late 20s feels about
turning
30.
Like, oh, I'm aging. And he talks, and also, like, the generational differences. He says, you know, when my grandfather was 27, he fought in Vietnam. When I was 27,
I built a birdhouse with my mom.
I was just hanging out, you know. And he also talks about feeling like he's growing older and out of touch. He's like, I used to make fun of boomers, and now these zoomers are telling me I'm out of touch. Oh, yeah, well, your phones are poisoning your mind, son. You're going to develop a dissociative mental disorder in your late 20s.
Yeah. I feel the same way.
Yeah, and he also, like, another thing he says in a spoken word part of the special is, like, I'm starting to think that maybe letting these soulless mega corporations manipulate the neurochemical drama of our children for profit was a bad call.
Yeah.
And that's like every like children's content channel on YouTube and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like the click channels and all the stuff that's designed to make your kids just keep watching. And it's like, oh my gosh, it's so messed up. And like, I mean, you could say what you want about children's television, but at least that goes through some kind of standards and like review. Mm-hmm. The stuff on YouTube is just like anybody can make it.
And a lot of times it was at least supposed to be educational. Like, I don't know. I kind of like scroll, you know, on Netflix where you can just hover over. I hovered over Cocomelon for a second and I was like, it looks so much like those wild, like, Russian children's.
Yeah, I think that's literally what it is. I don't think it's based in the United States.
It just feels like
Johnny Johnny Yes Papa.
It feels like filler for your child's time.
It literally is. It's just like, well, it's basically.
Now I may be misjudging Cocomelon.
No, I've actually seen Cocomelon. You're not.
It just feels like sounds and colors.
To entertain
a baby, and it's just, you know, hours and hours of your child's life.
And it's literally like Pavlovian at this point, because there was this trend on TikTok where people would play the Cocomelon song, and like their 2-year-old would come toddling out of like nowhere,
They'd fall down the stairs just to come and see it. It's like a dog. It's like Pavlov's dog. They hear Cocomelon, they're like, rah! Okay, we have basically the whole second half to go, so let's get through it real quick.
All right, so Don't Want to Know is the next one. Again, this reflects sort of his own self-criticism and how he, like, doesn't want, like, he's, as a creator, he kind of wants to know if you like it, but also doesn't want to know at all because he's
like, don't tell me. Actually, wait, do you like it? Wait, don't tell me.
Yeah, which is very relatable as a creator. Like, you know, it's just like, oh man, I want, like, I mean, I know as I make videos on TikTok and stuff, it's like, I probably shouldn't look at the comments as much as I do. I can't help it. And if I see even one comment that's like critical, I get like, so upset. Like, no. Even if it's like 10 comments that love it and one comment that's like, this is dumb. And I'm like, oh, my life.
Oh no. I know. I don't know. It's like people always say your brain absorbs negativity easier than positivity or negative feedback easier. It's very true. The next one is just called Shit, and it is relatable because it's basically like, what's the beginning? Like, what does he say in the beginning?
How we feeling out there like tonight? Yeah, I'm not feeling good.
I'm not feeling good.
It just talks about how he's feeling, and it's very, again, upbeat, like an ironically upbeat song. Where he's like, yeah, I'm feeling like shit. Ladies, do you feel like shit? Fellas, do you feel like shit?
It's like hey-ya, you know, at the
end. Exactly. And it's like, yeah, again, very relatable. Like, you know, just like, man, like, I just wasn't. I mean,
especially when you're at home a lot during the pandemic, and it was just kind of like the same over and over. You never see anybody. So
never
you
shower.
Just kind of like, you feel like a big bag of dog poop.
All time low. Let me try to remember how that one goes.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Do you remember that one?
No, I don't.
There's a speak part, and then there's this part where he, this one's kind of redundant, because it's like, my current mental health is rapidly approaching an ATL, which is an all-time low, not Atlanta. And then he talks about, feeling in my body way down deep inside me, I try to fight it, describe it, all right, a few things start to happen, my vision starts to flatten, my heart, it gets to tapping, and I think I'm gonna die. So yeah, I'm doing not great. So yeah, this is a very short song, and it's just like, it's basically kind of an extension of the Shit song. Yeah. It's like, I feel bad, things suck, I'm depressed.
Then there's Welcome to the Internet. It's a great song. Great song.
It really feels, it gives me the vibe of a Disney villain song. Yeah. Like, I hope that some very talented person has already, like, animated a full version of it. Mm-hmm. Because I could see him, like, wearing a costume and, like, walking people through the walls of the internet. It feels malevolent.
It feels like if Ralph Breaks the Internet was a musical.
Yeah.
They do go in the internet in that part. But it's basically like, here's everything all the time. And what I love about this song is it really encapsulates how, I don't know, I feel like the internet has so deadened, it's not even deadened my emotions, but it is kind of,
almost overwhelmed.
It's like shock therapy, well, not even shock therapy, it's like shock. Mm-hmm. Because this is like a very like tame example, but it's like you're scrolling through Instagram, right? And it's like, a dog and catching a ball, and here's how to make a delicious pie, and here's my grandmother saying her last words to her husband as he dies on his deathbed. says, no. Here's a husky, and it's singing. Like,
I know. He literally says, you
I
know.
Literally will see videos where it's like, this is the first time that my grandmother saw her grandbaby after COVID, and the woman is just weeping. And I'm like, oh.
Or like, people's like stories, Instagram stories, they'll like show a video of somebody getting like brutalized by the cops and then cut immediately to a picture of their cat or something. And it's like, what?
They're like,
it's like emotional.
Share this video. A man getting hit on the head. I'm like, oh. It's so, it is like you just see, and it's like not even just Instagram. I mean, it's like literally that having access to all the news all the time and all, like, I'm very pro news. I'm very like pro understanding, but like sometimes I'll just get news headlines during the day and I'll just casually look at it at work and it will hit me so hard.
Yeah.
Like, it's just stuff that I, just tragedy. Like, mm-hmm. just handed to you, like, on a notification, basically.
Yeah, and no trigger warning most of the time.
It's so rough.
Like, the lyrics, like, he talks about, welcome to the internet, what would you prefer? Would you like to fight for civil rights or tweet a racial slur? Be happy, be horny, be bursting with rage. We've got a million different ways to engage. Welcome to the internet, put your cares aside. Here's a tip for straining pasta. Here's a 9-year-old who died. We got movies and doctors and fantasy sports and a bunch of colored pencil drawings of all the different characters in Harry Potter fucking each other. It's just like, it's like the fucking emotional whiplash of, oh, here's how you strain pasta. Here's a tragic death of a child. Anyway, here's how it's Harry Potter. Like, you know, just like...
Yeah, exactly. It's really, it is like back and forth so much, especially social media. It, you know, it just become, it's become a place for social change. It's become a place for like activism. It's become a place for anger, but it's also a place for like everything else. Mm-hmm. And so it's like very easy to stumble upon things that are actually quite hard to watch.
You get like deadened by the trauma. Like, I know that that's one feeling I had during the quarantine. It's just like, everything was so bad all the time.
There was so much death. Yeah, it was like,
I couldn't even look. Couldn't really stop meaning anything. They're like, oh, we crossed the 500,000 deaths. I'm just like,
yeah,
this means nothing to me. Like, I hate to say that, but I mean, I'm just so empty. Like, there's just so much I can't even bring myself to care anymore. Like, oh, this person died. Oh, homelessness. Oh, people are getting kicked out of their apartments. Oh, people are starving. I mean, it's just so much that you're expected to just endure. And it's like, and you scroll. I mean, I definitely went through the whole thing where I was like scrolling through the news feed or whatever, and I'd see some random goofy story, and then I'd see some horrible tragedy. And it was like, and it wasn't just COVID. There was also like terrorist attacks and shootings. And I mean, it's just like.
Well, and what's hard too is like, you know, there are like, I do follow a lot of people who talk about activism, who talked about Black Lives Matter, and like, what is so hard is that it is hard to be active for every story. They're like, another black man was, you know, targeted by cops, another, you know, black child was, you know, bullied by, you know, school security.
It never stops.
You can't help everybody, and it makes you feel very, very helpless. Anyway, so that's part of the song. Yeah. Like,
there's a very slow. I know we're trying to get through this, but also there's a slower part of the Welcome to the Internet where he, things slow down before he picks it back up again. And he talks in the bridge, and he talks about it wasn't always like this.
This
your time,
is so good.
Right before the towers fell, circa 99. So he's kind of directing this at like the new, like Generation Alpha, I would say, not even Generation Z, like the babies and the kids who are kids now. Mm-hmm. It was like, right before the towers fell, circa 99, there were catalogs and travel blogs, a chat room or two. We set our sights and spend our nights waiting for you, you, insatiable you. Mommy let you use your iPad, you were barely two. Something about that line breaks my heart. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. It just does. and it did all the things we designed it to do. Now look at you. Oh, you're unstoppable, watchable. Your time is now. Your inside's out. Honey, how you grew. And if we stick together, who knows what we'll do. It's always the plan to put the world in your hand. And it's just like, again, it's sort of this like sort of melancholy like.
Yeah, it's like hopeful, but it's also very kind of scary because it's like, this is what this new generation is inheriting. It's this kind of wild west of the internet.
And it starts so young. Because, I mean, when we were kids, it was like, we're millennials, younger millennials. So we're in, like, that threshold era where the earliest parts of our childhood were spent playing outside, riding bikes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then the internet and all smartphones and stuff started coming when we were, like, teenagers. Mm-hmm. So it was like, we have these memories of, like, a pre- constantly connected world.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then we also came of age during the constant connection. But these new kids, they're literally have
never gonna,
known a life without iPads and stuff like that. And because so many parents, really parents who are in our generation, millennial parents, are giving their Gen Alpha kids like iPads when they're babies, and then that's all they ever see ever. Yeah. And it's like, these kids are literally being born into this constant glut of information, and they never have a moment of peace.
I don't know. Have I said this on this podcast before? But it's like, I did not have access to the amount to, like, I didn't have access to a fraction of the amount of content that these kids had.
No.
I had what was on PBS and what I had on VHS at the time. Like, that was it. And these kids, like, YouTube Kids is endless. It really almost is endless because, you know, it loops and it continues.
And there's always more stuff.
There's more.
And, like, these content
Streaming is too. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much more on Netflix, like, than I ever had even at the library.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the Cocomelon and, like, all of these other content factories that just make the same really shitty, like, animations and stuff like that, they can crank those out so fast. They literally will crank out, like, a 20-minute video of the same clips and just recycle them in different videos. And those shits get millions of views. If you go to these channels have hundreds of millions of subscribers, and each of those videos has a minimum of 10 million views. Yeah. I'm like, what the fuck?
It's insane. It's because parents put it on in the background and they just kind of let it go.
Yeah. It's just like, man, I did not lie. It's like,
worrying.
It's very concerning.
I mean, I think we're going to see what it does to kids' brains. Like, I know I sound like a boomer, but like, I really don't know what it would have been like to grow up with that kind of, like, I didn't have an iPad. I didn't have anything like that.
The closest thing I have was one of those, like,
I didn't even have a DS.
That, like, fake, the little e-reader, the fake leapfrog pad thing, where it was like games were preloaded into this little laptop. I thought that
I had CD-ROM games. I had a cell phone made out of paper that I made.
Yeah, me too.
I'm dating myself.
Oh,
still.
Lord, we are old. I know, but it's kind of crazy because you're right. I do feel like kind of a boomer when I say it, but I'm just like, I really don't feel like I'm going to give my kids an iPad when they're infants.
I just don't know what it's going to do to people neurologically. It's worrying to me because I know that, like, my attention span is worse when I'm trying to do multiple things at the same time. Like, I sometimes really can feel my brain overheating these days, especially with people talking in the background, music, watching something, my phone. Like, it is too much for me, even with just a few things. And to have that kind of, like, that constant stream of information and, like, I don't, all that from such a young age, I don't know what that would be like.
I mean, I'm just to the point, I can't be alone with my own thoughts for 5 minutes.
No, it's
like, I have to, I can't tell you how many times I've been, like, scrolling TikTok while the TV's on in the background and I'm playing music. I just have to have this constant noise.
Yeah, it's worrying. Anyway.
The next one is Bezos 2, which is just a simple song that he just screams Jeffrey Bezos.
Well, what I love is when he's like, Jeffrey Bezos, congratulations!
You did it!
You did it, yeah! Yay! Good job!
You won capitalism!
Wow! Okay, so the next song is my favorite, except for Bezos 1 is also very good, but That Funny Feeling is insanely good, and I think I like it the best because it's one of his more subtle, it's a little bit more kind of like, it's about that funny feeling you get when you realize that, like, something's wrong, or something in the culture that we live in right now is just kind of off. That's at least what I got from it, where it's like, I don't even remember. Like, I know one of the lines is like, a gift shop at the gun range and a mass shooting at the mall. It's kind of like these things that are kind of happening today that are like, this is not how it's supposed to be. And it is really, it's really poignant. It's really great, I think. But, yeah, like I said, it doesn't hit you over the head. It's very kind of subtle. It's a very quiet song.
Yeah, and he talks about, like, you know, a lot of simple, inane kind of things. Not all of which are bad, but some of them are just, like, observations. Like, he says, you know, stunning 8K resolution meditation app. In honor of the revolution, it's half off at the Gap. Deadpool self-awareness, loving parents, harmless fun. The backlash to the backlash of the thing that's just begun. Surgeon General's pop-up shop, Robert Iger's face, discount Etsy agit prop, Bugles take on race, female Colonel Sanders, easy answer, Civil War, the whole world's at your fingertips, the ocean's at your door, live action Lion King, Pepsi halftime show, 20,000 years of this, 7 more to go, carpool karaoke, Steve Aoki, Logan Paul, gift shop at the gun range, a mass shooting at the mall, reading Pornhub's terms of service, going for a drive, obeying all the traffic laws in Grand Theft Auto 5, fully agoraphobic, losing focus, cover blown, a book on getting better, hand-delivered by a drone, total dissociation, fully out your mind, Googling derealization, hating what you find, that unapparent summer air in early fall, the quiet comprehending of the ending of it all. And it's just like, I don't know, there's the way that he captures these very simple things in such a poignant kind of haunting way.
It was unsettling.
And a lot of people for a while were making like parodies of it on TikTok, where they were just like, and it wasn't like funny parodies, they were just like doing their own sort of stream of consciousness songs up to the same tune.
No, there's
a
point. Yeah. There's a point. And the point, I don't know, it's kind of these like very little, there's these little vignettes and like, and things that are kind of so symbolic of like the world today and how, you know, you get that funny feeling when you see these things or you witness them or, you know, especially, sorry, mm-hmm. especially some of the things that are like juxtapositions, like, you know, 8K sunning meditation app, like it's an app for meditating, but it's like, you know, it's the digital versus the natural, that sort of thing. Like, I don't know. It's just, I love that song.
And the line that was kind of creepy, I looked it up, the 20,000 years of this, seven more to go. So it's based on the idea that Paleolithic humans arrived in the Americas in the neighborhood of 20,000 years ago. And the 7 years, seven more to go is the climate deadline of 2028. If outputs of greenhouse gases are dramatically reduced by then, the worst effects of irreversible climate change could be avoided. So that's the idea that, like,
we only have 7 more years.
Yeah, we only have 7 more years before the world is completely fucked by climate change. Which, yikes. Feels...
It feels bad. Next is All Eyes on Me.
Which is one of my favorites. That probably is my absolute favorite. Like, that is mm-hmm. a close tie with, well, to the internet, but All Eyes on Me is again a very deep and very troubling and very sad song. Yeah. Where he talks about probably one of his rawest songs, where he gets yeah. the most emotional and the most real, and he talks about, you know, get your fucking hands up, get on out of your seats, all eyes on me, all eyes on me. Are you feeling nervous? Are you having fun? It's almost over. It's just begun. Don't overthink this. Look in my eye. Don't be scared. Don't be shy. Come on in. The water's fine. And he says, you know, you say the ocean's rising, like I give a shit. You say the whole world's ending, honey, it already did. Like, he's like, you know, just sort of giving up. And he's like, and there's an interlude where he speaks and he's talking about how he struggled with panic attacks. And so he retired from comedy 5 years ago. And just when he was getting the courage to go and perform again, COVID happened and he couldn't right. do live shows. And so there's that like sort of personal tragedy he inserts in there. And he like, he distorts his voice for most of the song, mm-hmm. and so it feels sort of haunting. And if somebody actually undistorted it on YouTube, and you could hear his voice breaking in several points, which is sad. Yeah. and so some people think he altered the voice to kind of disguise that. And yeah, again, what did you think about that one?
It's sad. It's very much like, you know, it's like ironic. It's like what he wants, what he can't have, what he doesn't want, you know, like all this attention, all of this like focus on him by the audience that he doesn't have. And yeah, it's a very powerful song.
He also says hands up, he says heads down, pray for me, and he's like, look at me, but you know, pray for him. Like, it's very yeah, sort of like a yeah. cry for help. Like, yeah. I need your attention, but I also
am it's like so that sad. Bravado, but like behind it is like yeah. this, you know, pain.
Then there's the goodbye song, which is the song. He says, "So long, goodbye. I'll see you when I see you. You can pick the street. I'll meet you on the other side." Do I really have to finish? Do returns always diminish? He mentions earlier in the special how he kind of doesn't want to finish the special.
Yeah.
Because once he finishes it, then what else am I going to do?
Yeah. Like, he spends a whole year working on it.
So. Yeah, which is a common, like, feeling. I feel like we yeah. all have, like, we want to keep ourselves busy. Right. And we have to set this big goal in mind, and then we don't, and we're like, oh, now what?
Well, now what? Right.
you know, because there's always something else to do. And he's like, does anyone want a joke when no one's laughing in the background? So this is how it ends. I promise to never go outside again. I'm losing power. Has it only been an hour? Here's a fun idea. How about I sit on the couch and I watch you next time? And he says, am I going crazy? But I even know. Am I right back where I started 14 years ago? I swear to God. Oh, do you want to guess the ending? If it ever does, I swear to God that all I ever wanted was a little bit of everything all the time, which is a callback to that song. He melodically calls back to most yeah. of the songs in the special in this song. And he's sort of, again, it's a very open, reflective song of just like, I'm doing this and it's almost done and I don't know what I'm going to do afterward and I feel so depressed and empty and am I even like still here? Am I still me? Am I still the person that I was, you know, when I started doing right. this? you know, is this the end? Am I, what's happening? You know, what am I going to do? And like telling these jokes, I mean, again, going back to the original question, is telling jokes really what I should be doing right now?
Right.
Does anyone want to hear jokes right now? Yeah. Especially when I'm not with a live audience, you know, like, you know, maybe you should be the one entertaining me. And then my favorite part of it is, so at the end of in the comedy song at the beginning, mm-hmm. he has this, if you wake up in a house that's full of smoke, don't panic, call me and I'll tell you a joke. If you see white men dressed in white cloaks, don't panic, call me and I'll tell you a joke. So that's the whole, again, he's the healing the world with comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, don't worry, if you're going through these like horrible tragedies, just call me and I'll tell you a funny and make you feel better.
Right.
And then in this one, he does a much slower sort of minor key version of it, where he's like, if I wake up in a house that's full of smoke, I'll panic. So call me up and tell me a joke.
Yeah.
It's just like, I need your help. I'm sinking.
I'm struggling. Exactly.
And then that's basically the last song. Well, then the actual last song is the one that plays during the credits. And it'll stop any day now. And he's literally just, it'll stop any day now. And that's all he says. That's but the interesting says. Part about the end of the special, not so much part of the song, but in the end of the special, what he does is he's finishes that song. He's like, you know, I'm finished playing, I'm standing inside or whatever. He finishes the song and he's just kind of sitting in silence. And then the door cracks open.
Yes.
And he gets up and walks out of the little house and he sees the audience, and they're like, well, you can hear, you know, can't see anybody, but there's a spotlight on him and you can hear the audience kind of reacting and applauding, and he kind of panics and tries to get back inside and he can't. And it's like this disturbing sort of thing where it starts out kind of funny and then it gets increasingly desperate to where he's trying to get back inside and he can't, and he's like, he just crumples to the ground in despair, and then it zooms out to another version of him that's watching it and smiling, and it's just like, oh my gosh, this is so meta.
It's crazy.
Like, it's like this feeling of just like desperation and this feeling of just like, again, sort of the looking for a reason to hide again. Like, I wanted to see what was outside. No, fuck it. I don't like this. I want to go back.
Right.
Like,
yeah. So that's the end. If it sounds depressing, it is. Yes. But like, and I mean, I did get like, it hit me pretty hard just because it was so relatable. But like, I would really recommend it. He does talk about suicide in it a little bit, so just warning. On
that. Do you? I'm asking you. Do you watch or have you watched BoJack Horseman at all?
I do not.
Okay. So, anyone in the audience, if you do watch BoJack Horseman, it is very much like that. That's the best way I can describe it. Where BoJack Horseman, for anyone who knows who has watched it, is an incredibly funny but also an incredibly sad and depressing show.
Yeah.
There's such a blend of like comedy and desperate, world-crushing depression. Mm-hmm. And so if you can handle that, you can handle this. But yeah, I would warn that it does mention suicide. It does mention some self-harm, and it's a lot. So make sure you're in the right headspace for it.
It feels authentic because, yeah, exactly. Like, you have to be in the right place for it. But like, you know, you can tell this is something he's really dealt with. And honestly, we're not that far away from 2020 yet. So not a lot has been made chronicling that year. So it's one of the first things that I've seen. I think that's why it was so powerful, is because I haven't seen a lot of stuff that was made during that year that referenced the year.
Uh-huh.
And it reminds you how hard things were. And I think that that's why, it, you know, it is a really real portrayal of what it's like to have depression. And I think that it's a, you know,
and it's still fresh.
It's still
like
fresh.
The feeling of 2020 and the desperation is still very fresh on my mind anyway, because like I said, it's not that far removed. This came out like 10 years after the quarantine to be a little different, but this is like so new.
Yeah, it feels very fresh. But it's also funny in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So it's not just sad. It is sad, but it is also funny, and we would definitely recommend it.
Yes. I enjoyed it very much. I've watched it twice now.
Nice.
So anyway, today we are drinking some spiced chai. We're actually drinking tea today. Be happy.
Delicious
you're proud of
tea.
Us. Yeah, because like the last several times I feel like we haven't been drinking tea.
Yeah.
But like I personally was suffering from a sinus headache today, so the tea was helpful. And it's
nasty weather.
Yeah. Oh gosh, it's so the barometric
humid,
pressure is
and then
nasty.
It rains like cats and dogs for like 20 minutes in the afternoon. And it's like
humid. Ugh, it sucks. The weather is awful. But yeah, and so that was the tasty, tasty tea. And the tea fact is that tea is good. I don't have any. I didn't.
Tea is. Have you ever had it iced?
Yes.
I might ask.
Yeah, oh yeah. Jeez, I never never heard of that. What an interesting...
It's good, you know, here's the recipe. You put ice in tea, and it's really good. Amazing. Usually a lot of sugar.
Did you find this in the, like, when you were scrolling the internet between
No,
the
I made it up.
Oh, wow.
I made it up. Nobody's ever thought of this
before. Invented tea. We're very proud of
it. I invented iced tea.
Iced tea, specifically.
Yeah. Anyway, have a great week, everybody. Bye. We hope you have a good week. Bye-bye.
For more shows like this one, visit rockcandyrecordings.com.